Okay, this is Newman versus Roberts. Could I have the entry of appearances, please, for the petitioners?
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is John Coates, registration number 8925, appearing on behalf of Laura Lincoln Ellison.
And who's the counsel? Go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. Ben Benjamin Tracy, registration number 3114, on behalf of Laura Lincoln Ellison.
Thank you. Mr. Coates, are you going to be doing the argument in this case?
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you. And for the respondent, please.
Your Honor, Damien Stone on behalf of the respondent, bar number 34587.
All right, thanks very much. This case has been set for 1 hour. That means each side has 30 minutes. Mr. Coates, if you wish to reserve some time for rebuttal, you should keep track of the clock yourself. So you just keep whatever amount you need. And whenever you're ready, Mr. Coates, you can go ahead.
May it please the court, counsel. This matter comes before the court on a petition for certiorari with respect to a effort to request the elimination of the automatic reversal rule for civil cases where trial courts have made good faith error in determining a for cause challenge. The cert was granted shortly after this court's ruling in People versus Abadi, where the automatic reversal rule for criminal cases was specifically eliminated. The crux of the argument that we would make is that, just as in Blakes versus Defoe, Justice Neighbors made comments that the automatic reversal rule was consistent with the then criminal automatic reversal rule for similar error. We would ask that this court now find that the automatic reversal rule for civil cases should be abandoned. The effects of the abandonment of the automatic reversal rule in civil cases would be that harmless error analysis would apply under Rule 61. With respect to these sorts of errors. And for this case, in these circumstances, upon an elimination of the automatic reversal rule, the court, as it's done in many other cases since the body, may remand the case to the Court of Appeals for determination of other issues that.
That's a pretty much a revolution in law, isn't it?
Your Honor, a revolution, I wouldn't call it that. We have 100 years of precedent. And what it is a realization that this is an unfair remedy for the type of circumstance that we're dealing with here, where six jurors who were all qualified, without a doubt, no dispute, no challenges for cause, constitutionally, federal, state, every which way, qualified, rendered a fair and impartial jury. When you look at the circumstances as precedent has evolved, the realization is, why are we doing that? I think the Hickman case of science is the current rule, such as here for Laura Lincoln, is she had a fair trial. Nobody claims it was not a fair jury. Yet here she stands with a reversal of the Colorado Court of Appeals on a technical issue that bears not a whit on either the fairness of the trial or on the propriety or correctness of the jury's verdict. I think what is being abandoned in the removal of the automatic reversal rule is a trial lawyer's concept that every peremptory challenge is so important and so outcome determinative in a case in the trial lawyer's mind that it has to be treated as a substantial right, which is exactly what the Blaze versus the Pope maintained. excuse me, as the federal, as this court has now observed, it's not really the substantial right of the judge. The issue is whether you get a fair and partial jury, which was satisfied in this case. Do I think that should be abandoned? You know, I believe that the elevation of this massive peremptory challenge to be a circumstance where it is thought to impact the trial such that a reversal should be automatic and mandated. I think that's a rule that has not been correct since it was dirt. Is it a nod to the head of all trial lawyers to think they can look into the souls of people and determine who might be best to sit in this jury? Sure it is, and it's historical, right? Sure it is. But it's when you get down to what actually happens in voir dire, you get a civil case where you have to exercise all of your peremptory challenge, where you may be kicking off one fully qualified juror or another simply because you have to use up all your challenges. It's hard to say that peremptory challenge use deserves the type of recognition that has been given and that's now been abandoned in most jurisdictions, including the federal jurisdictions. So I think it's an important right. I'm not saying there has to be, you know, a nod to clearly the 100 years of how it has worked in litigation. But I think it, at this point, particularly in both criminal and civil cases, we need to look it in the eye and say, hey, what are we doing here? We're retrying cases that don't need to be retried. We are this cost issue, cost of the judiciary, most significantly and very glaring here, the cost of the credibility of the system. What are we doing retrying a jury trial that was tried for 2 weeks and ended up with the verdict that it did before six people who were, again, not challenged to cause, legitimate jurors, no allegations of jury misconduct, no issues with respect to the actual verdict. The consequences of the abandonment of the automatic reversal rule significantly do nothing to trial practice. It doesn't change the method of doing perfect challenges or handling them. It doesn't change anything under Rule 47. It simply eliminates this remedy that is a disconnect from the alleged errors. In this case, Roberts has presented a number of arguments that suggests, you know, there's a play of oracles here that is unleashed on the elimination of the automatic reversal in civil cases. I would suggest that the reality is that the elimination of the rule changes nothing. It doesn't require any district court rule to change, any procedure to change, any methodology of dealing with either challenges for cause or peremptory challenges. It simply indicates that the substantial right of issue is going to be recognized as having a fair and impartial jury, not having a peremptory challenge lost because you had to use it to eliminate a juror that you believed was biased against you. In this case, when you review the voir dire for the three people involved, CB, KC, and JD, only one has been found by the Court of Appeals to have been inappropriately, the challenge for cause inappropriately denied. This court has obviously the power to consider the other issues, remand, look at those. But the reality is that neither of those other two jurors sat on the panel. And under harmless error analysis, where you cannot find that it is any way involved in the outcome of the case or the fairness of the case, given that the only relevant issue should be when you had a fair and impartial jury. When I think about the changes that are argued by the Public Trial Lawyers Association and Roberts, I look at it, well, there is nothing to change. There's nothing to do. This case was well decided. At worst, Judge Whitney overestimated the power of his instructions. Essentially, what he held was that he believed at the closing of the voir dire conference that the instructions of the law would advise the jurors that any of these biases and expressions of concern that they had would be eliminated by the instructions, and therefore he denied the challenges for cause. If that was error, in spite of the arguments that have been submitted, it would be hard pressed to call that bad faith. In the absence of something such as bad faith, as talked about the lobby, there's no further inquiry on those issues. Is this trial process here, or is it something greater that involves plain error, this would have to be in a civil context, of which essentially plain error is not a concept that's applied in civil cases. I think if I run a case, it talks about it, but if these concepts of plain error, as well as do they relate to structural error, how do those pieces fit in? I'm suggesting structural error is not a concept that gets drug over to the civil arena, if they have no place there. Essentially, error in a civil case where there's no constitutional right to a civil trial, no constitutional right to a jury trial at all. Those kinds of issues don't apply directly. If a judge runs them up, you know, denies every peremptory challenge without any analysis, otherwise abuses his power of authority, which is the specter raised in some of the brief arguments.
Could I interrupt you there while you're talking about the distinctions that we've made in the criminal law, rather fine distinctions about different kinds of error that don't seem to be reflected in the same way, anyway, in civil law? Given that, a big part of the argument or the explanation in the Botany for departing from well-established precedent was this separate development of the distinctions between structural error and trial error and the meaning of harmless error as a likelihood that it was an effect on the verdict. Given that, do you believe that the rationale basically for us departing from precedent in the criminal context applies equally to the civil context, or are you just basically arguing this is a bad rule too, and there are reasons why we should depart from precedent, although they may be different?
I think I would go at that question saying that the concept of structural error in the criminal case is a broad statement saying that if the activities in trial, the trial process errors, whether under cumulative error rules or otherwise, add up to a fundamentally unfair trial, then the verdict is reversible. I think that's not. It doesn't translate very well to the civil. The concept in the civil case would be, is there such a circumstance in a civil case where we talk about cumulative errors or error that cannot be handled under Rule 61's harmless error analysis, which instructs us to disregard any error that doesn't, you know, involve or affect substantial rights of the parties or inconsistent with substantial justice. I would suggest to the court that under Rule 61, the concept of inconsistent with substantial justice is about as broad a concept is the concept of structural error. It provides a vehicle where a court could address the parade of oral rules that are suggested by the appellee. But do we transfer them back? I don't think it works. Because again, in the Vista case, I believe, the only case I found with respect to whether there's cumulative error argument in a civil case, just simply said they hadn't found a case that found cumulative error as a concept. So a civil case, could each error be harmless and you never get to a circumstance of structural error? I don't think I'd buy that concept either, in the sense that a court could find there's so much error in this trial that we're going to find that it is the court that gave inconsistent with substantial justice. And obviously it needs to deal with the right that makes any difference. Was whether you got to go at recess here and there during the trial versus whether you got a fair jury, two different things.
If I'm understanding, I appreciate the nuance and the distinctions, but should I take that to mean your feeling is the Novotny and the rationale for it do not provide a similarly strong reason to depart for precedent of a civil?
No, you know, I think they provide the direct. The body essentially says that one party getting more preemptory challenges than another in and of itself is not structural error, but something greater and bigger has to happen.
And I think, and maybe I can hone down to the one specific point, I thought a part of that rationale, and maybe you would disagree as it comes out objectively, but I thought a part of the rationale, a big part was that we'd come to the point of saying automatic reversal only is the effect, is the remedy of structural error in the criminal context. And therefore, if something doesn't meet the definition of structural error, there cannot be a bright line rule with regard to reversal. One must always consider the effect on the outcome of the case. If we don't have the concept of structural error in the same way in civil, does that same formula apply or provide a rationale for overturning a bright line rule of automatic reversal in the civil context?
Your Honor,
have I asked that so complicatedly?
as I perceive it, we have what the court is indicating in criminal cases of structural errors. We're not letting these cases get retried where incidents in the trial don't add up to something that fully impacts the justice and equity and propriety of the conviction. I think that translates directly over to the civil case in the sense that harmless error analysis works in the civil case the same way it works in the criminal case. Rule 61 provides all of the analysis that's necessary to deal with the type of error that we're dealing with here. An error in one side apparently having more peremptory challenges than another. There's no other issue with respect to that.
Since you, just one further on that, you say about harmless error under Rule 61 provides the similar basis. And I guess my question is, because I didn't really see it in the briefing, and I have to confess I don't have as much experience in this area, has the description of harmless error in the civil context under Rule 61 been tied to a substantial likelihood that the outcome of the case was not affected, which seemed to be essential to our ruling in the criminal case, or does harmless error mean something different? Has it been described differently? So,
no, Your Honor, I think the Bannock versus Thomas case, which says an error affects a substantial right and it be said with fair assurance that the error substantially influenced the outcome of the case or impaired the basic fairness of the trial itself. That is the harmless error analysis that's applied to the type of error that we're looking at here.
In civil cases. Yeah, and we said that's four in a number of opinions, right?
That's correct.
Every error requires reversal.
Correct. Bly versus Story would be another one. There's a number of them listed in there.
But here's my concern about the Novotny, which is where you start here, is that there's all kinds of policy involved in the criminal law that has to do with the community, accountability and community rights, defendant fairly convicted of crime can be subject to punishment. It seems to me this whole body of plain and harmless and structural is all geared around different policy issues having to do with the criminal law. I mean, do you have any reaction to that? I mean, that's why this whole structure was set up, you know, make sure it was a fair conviction, but if it is, you know, there's an interest in the public, a strong interest in that person, that conviction standard.
Your Honor, my reaction to that is that if this is where we go in a criminal case, it's compelling that we apply a similar and consistent rule in a civil case. But I don't want to stand up here and say the civil cases are even less important, there's no constitutional right to a jury trial in a civil case, the community may not be as invested in the outcome of civil cases. I don't think that discussion works. I think that the automatic reversal rule is what is being eliminated. The rest of trial process, both criminal and civil, are not changing. And in fact, in the civil arena, the only argument someone could make is that the harmless error rule is somehow inadequate, and I would suggest to the court that it's not. And this again is a response to a suggestion of an appellee that we develop something akin to a structural error rule for civil cases. Cases are all cited in the brief. around the country. That notion's been largely rejected. And again, part of it being that, you could say it, civil cases, the standards in civil cases perhaps can be lower than the standards that are applied in a criminal case where we're talking about somebody's liberty. But in this case, and you bring it back to this case, and there is a paralyticness in this case, the facts here are that there was a fair and impartial jury that tried this case, heard it, and rendered a verdict for appeals, found no material error in any other aspect of the trial related to Herbs, yet we find ourselves at the prospect of break of retrying a case that should not be retried.
Mr. Coates, can I ask you a question before you reserve? You talked about the adequacy of the harmless error rule. How would somebody demonstrate that there was harmful error?
In the context of a peremptory challenge where that was used to eliminate a juror for cause, who was erroneously allowed to erroneous ruling on cause, there's nothing to prove. In other words, the trial process here was the voir dire that was done. None of the jurors who are issuing that challenge sit on a panel, there is no error in that panel. Unless you find that the fairness of the trial as whole and harmless error would have made that trial improper. So I think that this concept that if we eliminate the automatic rule, there's some hole left in jurisprudence for challenging the makeup of a jury, I don't believe is correct. If all the jurors who sit were properly qualified under the statute and the rules, including Rule 47B, which is an issue here, 7E, then there is no error to be solved. Any other error that would involve that jury would be post-trial error, where you have influences of the jury from outside sources that racial bias them. So I think it goes to the automatic affirmance issue that has been kicked around and addressed, I think, pretty definitively by the court of Wise. I think it's a bit of a misnomer to say automatic affirmance. The reason it's affirmed is because a fair and impartial jury heard the case. There isn't anything to reverse. There's no issue to be fixed. There's no problem that you're truly addressing, other than this notion that peremptory challenge was a substantial right, which I think is what is abandoned when the automatic reversal rule is eliminated.
Counsel, it sounds like you had also mentioned the notion of the bad faith exception in terms of showing harm of this error.
Well, again, I think in the body they use that as an example of how such an error involving peremptory challenges and cause challenges could become a circumstance that involves structural error. I would say that fits the comments made here about Rule 61. If there is bad faith, then those activities would be inconsistent with substantial justice, and therefore the court would be obligated to reverse whatever that circumstance is, whether it involves cause challenges, peremptory challenges, those sorts of things.
Counsel, before you move on, can I ask you, you started out your argument today saying that our precedent involving the civil context actually was dependent or related to our precedent in the criminal context. And since those underpinnings in the criminal arena are gone, they should go in the civil arena as well. And that's kind of what you were arguing. But I'm wondering if you could flesh that out a bit. I mean, I guess you referred to Blades versus Defoe, but is it a larger argument than that? I mean, help me out.
Your Honor, I don't believe it's a larger argument than that. In Defoe's, Justice Neighbor cites two cases, Bustamante versus People and People versus Broyles. Those two cases are criminal cases that had applied automatic reversal rules to criminal cases at that time in whatever it was, 1985. Is that the only thing Justice Neighbor talked about in the case? No. But if that was the underpinnings of the case saying, hey, we should be consistent, I think he uses the word consistent, that the civil rules should be consistent with the criminal. And my opening comments go to that. makes no analytic sense to me that you'd have one rule for the criminal cases and another rule for the civil case. And from an argument point of view, having limited the criminal support for the civil automatic rule, which nobody does, I think that the rule should be abandoned. And you can't look at the opinions that have come out from this court since the Botany and court appeals opinions that have come out, and where the analysis has gone is, again, precisely if you don't have an unfair juror sitting on the panel, a prejudiced or biased juror sitting on the panel, then we're not going to use reversal as a hammer for some other purpose. And it's really like, I'm going to punish Laura Newman LLC in order to sustain, or in order to, I guess, I mean, look, advise Judge Whitney that he made an error in this case, and therefore, even though he ended up with a fair and impartial jury, we're going to reverse it. Errors happen in trial cases. Voir dire, you got a pretty good flavor in the briefs of different lawyers' views of voir dire. Anybody who's trying to face a federal court would be hard-pressed to argue some of the things that have been presented for you with respect to what goes on in voir dire. It's a important part of the trial. Again, when a judge deals with jurors who are often trying to put up arguments that support an asset for just your whole veneer, they need to be given the discretion to deal with that. I think that's what Judge Whitney was doing here. And to say that you're doing something different, I think would be incorrect. Thank you.
Mr. Stone?
May it please the court, Damien Stone on behalf of the respondent, T. Lon Roberts. The court errors at the beginning, the middle, and the end of this case infected the entire framework under which this case was tried, and it deprived Lon Roberts of his fundamental right to a fair trial. In the U.S. Supreme Court's case in Rivera, the court noted that without more, single loss of a peremptory strike is not per se reversible error. This case is the case with more. We ask that this court affirm the reversal of the jury verdict in favor of Newman LLC and remand this case for a new trial. There are three primary reasons for doing so. One is that the facts and the jurisprudence are different. Two, the combined errors of the trial court deprive Lon Roberts of his right to a fair trial. And three, there are significant public policy issues to support that as well. With regard to the first issue, jurisprudence, in Rivera, the court noted, well, all the cases considering the automatic reversal rule focused on legal challenges asserted based on a right to a fair and impartial jury trial. And that was in Ross, that was in Martinez Salazar, Nevada, and Rivera. In contrast, Lon Roberts is arguing here that his fundamental right to a jury was violated due to those combined errors. In addition, Rivera noted that in applying this new way of looking at loss of peremptory strikes, that the court should not ignore multiple combined errors that are present. And in those instances, that can equate to a due process violation. In addition, all those cases dealing with automatic reversal rule dealt with the loss of one peremptory strike. So if the court is going to transfer or think about transferring over that analytical structure to the civil context, it has to take into account that part of the analysis as well. And here, although we're in a civil case, Lon Roberts has a due process right to a fair trial. The court, as far back as Halliburton v. Denver, recognized that a civil litigant has a right to a trial, and this court reaffirmed the principle that a fair trial is a part of due process when it cited N. Ray Richardson in the McCrander case, and that principle still holds true here. And whether we're talking about a loss of substantial right or structural error, I think really those encompass very similar principles. This court in Nevada talked about structural error and what that actually means, and that means that it affects the entire trial process, and it necessarily renders that unfair. And that was echoed in Rivera, that the error that renders the trial fundamentally unfair is, in fact, a structural error. So there's no analytical reason I can think of that you can't have that same errors or multiple errors cause that effect in a civil case.
Can I interrupt you?
Yes, Your Honor.
So, but in Novotny, we made pretty clear we thought the U.S. Supreme Court had decided, and we decided, that an erroneous ruling on a peremptory challenge, at least in the criminal context, that resulted in a loss for the defense counsel, was not structural error. Are you suggesting that it should be a different rule in civil, or are you asking for a rule, and maybe you can draw all this sure. together, that it can be structural error, but it requires more than simply an erroneous ruling with regard to a peremptory?
That takes me to my first point in terms of the facts that are different. I agree that that was the ruling, and looking back at all the jurisprudence in the federal court and also a recent case that came out of the Ninth Circuit, it was an Alaska case, I think it was called Avis, in which the automatic reversal rule was up on appeal in relation to a civil case where the Supreme Court denied cert. So looking at that, I see pragmatically that potentially that rule would get extended. So how is this case distinguishable from Novotny? And it's distinguishable on the facts because we're not dealing with the loss of one error. We're dealing with the loss of anywhere from 2 to 3 bias errors. The Court of Appeals did not address our challenges to Mr. Kreider as well as Ms. Dennis because of the existence of the Blades rule. And so it said it didn't have to consider those challenges. Both the petitioner and respondent agree on de novo review that this court can consider those, and we submit that the court should, in the interest of expediency and bringing this.
Well, can I focus you right there? So does that amount to an argument then that we should modify the rule of Blades to say there is automatic reversal, but it's only where there are multiple errors? Or do the multiple errors go in your mind to showing that it's not automatic reversal at all, but rather that's a reason why it's not harmless?
Two-part answer to that. I believe that I agree with the dissent and Novotny that there's nothing that changed in Colorado over the past 14 years to justify retracting the automatic reversal rule. And I think there are separate considerations in the civil context that aren't present in the criminal context for maintaining that rule. And the Blades Court talked about those reasons. It talked about that the purpose of the cause strike is to get rid of cognizable bias, and the purpose of the peremptory strike is to go after inferred bias. And that becomes even more important in the civil context when you're dealing with a burden of proof that is very close.
May I ask you the nature of that argument? Does that in effect say you think we erred in Novotny and we shouldn't extend our error?
That's correct, John.
Okay, thank you.
Just being honest. But that also takes me back to the facts of this case are distinguished. We had those three strikes. And Mr. Kreider said he couldn't accept that a person attacked in a bar, it could be his fault, or that it couldn't be the person's fault he got attacked in the bar, or no duty to protect anyone and had to be a victim's fault. And yet Ms. Dennis, who repudiated the theory of the petitioner's case as well. So the loss of those three additional peremptory challenges prevented the plaintiff from using those in the manner intended. And it became even more apparent that from looking at the voir dire transcript, it echoed what this court had talked about in Blades, that those strikes for the purpose of inferred bias, we had three jurors that sat on the panel that exhibited inferred bias. One was a 10 to 15 year employee of the insurance industry. It's going to have an inferred bias against plaintiffs. You had Ms. Engelberg, who testified that her brother and her parents were sued by a plaintiff, and the plaintiff lied. There was an inferred bias against plaintiffs there. In addition, you had Mr. Bell, who's cut from the same cloth as Ms. Dennis, and Ms. Dennis had indicated she grew up in Sturgis, the home of the Harley-Davidson rally, drinking and fighting, part of the culture. If somebody gets in the way of a fight, it's their fault. And Mr. LaBelle was a manager of a Harley-Davidson distributorship, so they shared that culture. So those are the things that peremptory challenge is supposed to be used for, to strike people with deferred bias. And again, the burden of proof is so close, those small biases can really tip the scale where you don't have that type of situation in a criminal case because the burden of proof is so high. In addition to those errors, the trial court prevented Lawton Roberts from asking the jury panel if anybody shared the same biased beliefs as Mr. Prior. And the court cut us off. And that's significant because if this court were to apply a Nevada outcome determinative rationale, the trial court prevented us from developing the record that could allow us to establish that a juror with bias sat on the jury, and that was improper. Moving to the middle of the case, we also have the erroneous direct verdict, and so we will get a retrial on LNH matter. And at the end of the trial court, although the Court of Appeals has recognized that it was erroneous to dismiss LNH, the trial court allowed the dismissed party's counsel to give a closing argument. And that was significantly prejudicial. Which leads me to the second point, which is the combined errors. And the petitioner had indicated in his argument that the court hasn't recognized that concept, but it has. And I filed a supplemental authority notice to the court in regard to Oaks v. People, and then also People v. Reynolds. And in that case, this court recognized that multiple harmless errors, when considered separately, might not require a reversal. But when considered in the aggregate, they may demand that a reversal take place because there is no right, or a right to a fair trial is violated. And in Oaks, the defendant was found guilty of murder. And on appeal, in front of this court, the court found the evidence clearly established that defendant's guilt. Nonetheless, the court went back, looked at the individual harmless errors, and considering those errors together, found that it required a reversal because it showed the absence of a fair trial. And we believe that that same principle should be applied in this case. When we come to its decision, this court said a right to a trial is not dependent on the amount of evidence that's presented at a trial, and it's antithetical to the idea of due process to subject somebody to an unfair trial. And the same is true here. We have multiple errors, and when you look at the multiple amounts of prejudice caused a lot of robbers, you see that he did not receive a fair trial. And that principle was reaffirmed by this court 12 years later in People v. Reynolds. So looking at the errors here, we have the erroneous directed verdict. As this court's aware, same individuals who owned LNH also owned Newman LLC. So when the court granted that directed verdict, they sent a message to the jury that the remaining claims of Lawton Roberts had no merit. And that was further compounded when the court allowed the dismissed counsel's attorneys to give a closing argument. In addition to that, I talked about the prejudice associated with the trial court denying our ability to use peremptory challenges in the way that they were meant to be used to strike those jurors that had identifiable inferred bias. In addition, we have two additional errors the court made with regard to the bias challenges that the court should have granted. There were clear indications of bias. There was no rehabilitation of either Mr. Kreider or Ms. Dennis, and the court should have struck those jurors as well.
Mr.
Oh, please, I know you're going.
I'm sorry if I might interrupt you right here. I guess what troubles me, or struggling with a little bit with your argument, is we have been answered in a very narrow question, which is simply to examine whether we need to hang on to or get rid of the automatic reversal rule in Blaze versus Atfall. And my concern is that all of this extraneous arguments that you're making don't look good to that question. If we retain that rule, then you wouldn't. If we don't retain that rule, it would seem that, I think, that these various arguments might go toward establishing that harm, you know, the error was not harmless, such that reversal is still warranted. But I'm just not sure that that is necessarily before us today. So I mention that because I guess I prefer that you sort of focus on the narrow set question that we accepted.
And Your Honor,
in terms of like whether we should hang on to the Blaze versus Atfall automatic reversal rule here in the civil context, and if so, why?
And I guess I disagree with you that it doesn't impact that analysis, because as part of, if this court is to make a decision of transferring that rule to a civil context, the Supreme Court has said that you have to look at whether that loss of that strike impacted the substantial rights of the party. So if this court were to transfer it over, that wouldn't stop the analysis of this court. This court still has an obligation to determine whether that strike, in combination with potentially any other errors as noted by Rivera, require a reversal or cause the litigant to lose a substantial right.
Could I just say, I'm not sure if I understand. I'm sort of in the same quandary now, or maybe the same place that Justice Marcus is. So is that an alternate argument then? You're saying if we overturn the Blaze automatic reversal rule, then nevertheless we should find that it was that it affected a substantial right here because of the combined errors?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay. And I guess what I would ask, what I thought Justice Marcus was asking was, the question we're first concerned with, though, is should we overrule the Blaze automatic reversal rule?
And the answer to that would be no. I don't believe that this court should do it. I'm just taking a pragmatic approach, looking at what this court's done, what this court has said, and what the Supreme Court has done with a civil case in terms of denying cert.
I guess maybe what I was asking is, and do you have reasons for thinking we shouldn't overturn that?
Yeah, for the for some of the issues that I was raising before, which is that you have 100 years of Colorado precedent, which has established that the automatic reversal rule is in fact the rule in Colorado, and there's nothing that's happened between the last time that principle was affirmed and now. And it went back to what this court had said in Blaze as what the purpose of those strikes are for. And one of them was, you know, to get rid of the cognizable bias. And the other one is to be used for the inferred bias as well. And then you look at the difference between the criminal system and the civil system in terms of, in some cases, we have a sense of parity in terms of the peremptory challenges that are being given out, and both parties get an equal amount, and then also that the court's obligation or the court's role is to grant those challenges for bias, and we're not supposed to use our peremptory challenges to correct those judicial errors.
Okay, thank you.
So it's a tried and true litigation process, and we do depend upon this to shape up the jury. And it's proof. It's that. I mean, generations of lawyers have practiced underneath it, and for it and with it. And it just allowed you to have a fairer juror. That's the whole thing, right?
Yes, Your Honor. If you look back, it's 100 years, that's been the rule of law, and I submitted to this court I would be hard-pressed to find any attorney, any civil attorney, that would walk into trial and voluntarily give up two or three peremptory strikes. I just don't think anybody would do that at the beginning of the trial. And the reason is because we all know, as trial attorneys, that that would be unfair to do that. And again, without those peremptory challenges, it ruins the person. It ruins the person's purpose, and slowly erodes the purpose of voir dire and what that is supposed to do. It's supposed to pull out that inferred bias that allows you to get rid of those jurors that are biased against your case. And in Colorado, we have that mandatory requirement that attorneys are allowed to participate in voir dire versus in the federal system where the judge can just do that and has the discretion to allow the attorneys to question the jury.
Could I ask you a question? I don't remember if you all discussed this that much in the briefs, but when did the concept of harmless error in civil law develop?
I can't answer that question, Your Honor.
100 years ago? Don't know.
I don't know.
Can I follow up on that? Just maybe to ask it a little bit differently. What do you do with Rule 61, which does recognize the concept of harmless error? So how do you read that consistently with your position?
I read it consistently because it invokes that idea again of a substantial right. And this court identified in Blades v. Defoe that your right to a peremptory strike constitutes a substantial right. So if you're losing that substantial right, then it would be error underneath that analysis.
Thank you.
You're welcome. There are also several public policy issues that I think are significant in this case. It's, as this court indicated in the dissent, it's an important issue to ensure a robust and competent judiciary. And this court, at least considering the issues in Novotny and also making comments in the oral argument, indicated that one of the most common basis for reversal is in fact errors in jury selection. So for me, that identifies that there is an issue at the trial court level, and that some of the or trial court and the judges maybe don't have all the tools that they need to perform that role, whether it's in the arena of additional guidance from this court or additional education about that process. And what Novotny does, or an extension of Novotny to the criminal or the civil arena does, is it ensures that weakness in the system is going to continue. It creates a reason to ignore it or an excuse for an error at the trial court level without actually dealing with the underlying issue. So it ensures that it will persist. And what's concerning for me, reading some of the cases that have now unfolded in the criminal context that were cited by the petitioner as supplemental authority, is that the Court of Appeals is coming to the conclusion that one or all losses of peremptory strikes is not reversible. And that's also a little bit counter to what was talked about in Rivera about multiple errors maybe causing due process violations. In addition, in that recent case, People v. Friends, the Court of Appeals did not even analyze whether the trial court committed error or not, because they concluded it didn't have to even do that analysis because of the ruling in Nevada. And so I'm fearful that extending that case to the civil case, the same results are going to happen. Not only will the Court of Appeals no longer give guidance to the court as to what should or should not happen with bias challenges, but they will be completely excused from making those errors. The other significant issue, public policy issue, is what was echoed by this court in Oaks v. People. That as a matter of public policy, the Oaks court found that society is best served by placing that fundamental right to a fair trial above all else. And if this court affirms that
reversal of the jury verdict in Newman LLC. It does that, ensures that Lawton Roberts' fundamental right preserves over other considerations. And I think it's also instructive or important in Oaks v. People. This goes to a little bit to what Justice Marquez had asked me about this being a very singular issue, and wanted to focus on that. And it seems to be in that presentation of the question, it's putting the ends as being predominant. So are we transferring that rule over to the civil context or not? And the court and Oaks repudiated that type of approach and said, hey, we have to look at everything that happened in the trial to determine if somebody's fundamental right to a fair trial is violated. And we can't just say this case, Ron Roberts, is going to be potentially rubber stamped for the extension of Nevada, until we ask that the court consider that issue as well. Also, within the briefing from the petitioner, there is several errors or defenses asserting that Lawton Roberts had somehow waived various due process arguments. If the court looks at the petition on cert, you'll see that the petitioner raised the issue of due process, raised the issue of fairness and a fundamental right to a fair trial. So all those issues are properly before this court. In addition, in the Court of Appeals, in our reply brief, we responded to this Rivera court and implicated Lawton Roberts' fundamental right to a fair trial. So all those issues we submitted properly before this court.
Mr. Stone, while you're pausing, let me ask you the same question that I asked Mr. Coates, and that is, just on the pure jury selection and the peremptory challenge, how do you think someone would go about showing harmless error in that context? I mean, understanding your argument about cumulative error, but putting that aside, how would someone demonstrate harmless error?
Just assuming that the only issue we're dealing with is the...
how would you demonstrate harmless error or harmful error, I guess, on the flip side, in the peremptory challenge arena?
I would rely on the rule that's been in place for the past 100 years, which is if you lose a peremptory strike.
I understand that that's your argument, but I'm asking just practically, going back to what I asked Mr. Coates, is there a way to demonstrate some kind of harmful error? Did you have to show that someone that you, would you have to afterwards say, Judge, I would have exercised this peremptory challenge on this person? I mean, how would you go about doing that? If your answer is you can't, I understand that as well.
Well, I think that's what the dissent talked about in the Botany, that you create a almost impossible task at that point to establish that a biased juror sat in the jury box.
So your answer is it would be very difficult.
Yes, it would be very difficult, if not near impossible, to do that.
Does that remain true even if there are multiple errors as to challenges? In other words, does it take some combination of an incorrect ruling on a for-cause challenge resulting in the expenditure of peremptories, the loss of peremptories effectively, plus something else like an error in directed verdict? I'm just trying to understand. Could it just be based on problems with the challenges, or does it have to be that and something else in your estimation post Nevada?
Post Nevada, if we're applying that rationale from Nevada?
Right.
If we're applying that
rationale. Because I think that's what Justice Boatwright is ultimately getting. I don't mean to prevent this, but I think
so. So if we assume for the purposes of this argument that the court extends that Nevada rationale to the civil context, then under that rationale, I think that you would have to have a loss of a peremptory strike plus something else. If you're following that case law from Rivera, and then this what this court implied in its decision in Nevada as well.
because nothing to look at once doesn't get any better when it's nothing to look at times two or three in terms of just.
No, I think when you get into two or three, that's a different issue or a different.
And that's what I'm trying to understand. How is it different?
It's because then you're looking at it collectively, as the court in Rivera indicated, that if you're talking about a pattern of repeated errors, on behalf of the judge, that then is infecting more of your substantial right to a fair trial. And that's what the court was alluding to, explicitly stated in its opinion. And then this court has identified it as being a substantial right. So the more substantial rights that you lose collectively, they amount to something more than just harmless error. And the courts recognize that concept in Oaks and also be People v. Reynolds.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Were there any other questions from the panel? So in closing, this case is the case that had more. There were multiple trial court errors that violated or resulted in the loss of Lon Roberts' fundamental right to a fair trial. This court has had strong judicial precedent over the past 100 years of enforcing the idea that a loss of a peremptory strike in a civil context is, in fact, loss of a substantial right. And we ask that this court reaffirm that principle with respect to Lon Roberts. If the court does not or alternately chooses not to and extends that binding principle to Lon Roberts, as part of that analysis identified by the Supreme Court, this court also has to look as to whether that error substantially affected the rights of Lon Roberts. And we ask that this court affirm the reversal of the jury verdict and remand this case for a new trial. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Mr. Stone. Mr. Coates?
May it please the court. Justice Boothroyd, the comment that I think I heard in the end of the meeting is the concept of a more fair juror, Justice Hobbs. The concept of a more fair juror is not a concept that I believe exists in current jurisprudence. Jury selection involves a right to reject some jurors who are at that time past their cause. Peremptory challenges are being used. You don't get to select jurors, you get to reject certain jurors using your peremptory challenges, and that's particularly true in a civil case. And adding the concept that there is a more fair juror is kind of like saying there's greater abuse of discretion. You either have abuse of discretion or you don't. And I think the concept here is that when we ask them, how do you prove if the jurors who didn't get excused for cause didn't sit on the panel, how do you prove that something has affected a substantial right of a litigant? And I think the answer is that circumstance will never add up to harmful error because the panel is not tainted. So the only way you could address such an issue would be to look to the more global thing is the process in its entirety in the structural error discussion inconsistent with substantial justice under Rule 61. And is that an amorphous concept? It's about as amorphous as it gets, and why there isn't concepts of cumulative error, particularly in civil cases. And again, I don't think these issues are before this court at all. There's another, it's a syllogism of sort. If I had known Novotny would go into effect and the Blaze versus Defoe would be overruled, then I would have done something different at trial. That's the primary argument that's been put before you by Roberts. It's not a correct argument. There was nothing different to do at trial. Would he objected to the circumstance where he was cut off with Kreider when there was no objection made at the time? Would he have asked for more preempts? Would he have made a speech about who he would have kicked if he could have kicked somebody else? None of those issues are affected by the elimination of the automatic reversal rule, but those were errors at the time, they were errors at the time, and they were waived when no objections were made.
Excuse me, counsel, since your time is short, I interrupt you right there. Would you disagree with opposing counsel, though, that even if we extended the botany into this arena and reversed the blades versus the full automatic reversal rule, would you disagree, though, that the erroneous denial of the challenge of cause could be taken into account with other alleged errors collectively to say that the judgment in a case should be reversed?
And I believe the answer is what I stated. The answer is no if the panel that ultimately served was a fair and impartial jury. Could you say, take it out of that arena, that particular error is never going to be harmful error? Could you say that added to that, you were not allowed to give any arguments, you weren't allowed to cross-examine any witnesses, all of your evidence was denied? Could that add up to be something inconsistent with substantial justice?
In other words, the concept of cumulative error in the criminal context simply doesn't work in the civil context.
I don't think it works, but if you're going to say it works under Rule 61's amorphous comment, but that you don't deal with any error unless it's inconsistent with substantial justice or involves a substantial right. And the substantial right here was to get a fair and impartial jury. You got it. Coming up with new objections and new arguments that you might have done something to suggest the gamesmanship of peremptory challenges, which Novotny has put to rest.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, thank you, sir. Mr. Coates, we appreciate your argument today, and as do we appreciate your argument, Mr. Stone. The court will be in recess until 1:30.